Boeing customer says he has details on the next Dreamliner delay. A passenger is injured in a fire on a 767 over South Carolina. And the U.S. Air Force breaks the sound barrier on an alternative fuel. This is Aero News. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for downloading this AeroCast. Here's what's up in aviation for Friday, March 21st, 2008. A necessary structural change to the center wing box of Boeing's 787 Dreamliner may further delay the plane's first flight, currently scheduled to occur 1 year after the airliner was formally announced. Stephen Udvar-Hazy, chairman of the International Lease Finance Corporation, told the Associated Press he believes, based on new information from Boeing, that the first composite body Dreamliner won't take to the skies now till late 2008, with deliveries to customers pushed back to the third quarter of 2009. The center wing box connects the airliner's wing assemblies to the fuselage and contains a fuel tank. Hazy believes the design change will require retrofits to the planes already on the assembly line in Everett, Washington. For the moment, Boeing spokeswoman Yvonne Leach has declined to confirm the rumor. Quote, "We're working on completing our assessment so we can give our customers new delivery schedules. We'll share the details of all this when we're ready." Unquote. An in-flight fire broke out in the cargo compartment of a Delta Airlines 767-300 Wednesday, burning a passenger and forcing an emergency landing at Greenville-Spartanburg Airport just before 5 p.m. local time. Flight 1819 departed Raleigh-Durham just before 4 p.m. en route to Atlanta. There were 200 passengers on board, and the airliner had just passed Greenville when the fire was detected. GSP spokeswoman Rosalind Weston told WYFF-TV, "The flight crew reported smelling smoke in the cockpit. Airport manager Larry Holcomb said one passenger was treated for burns from the fire. No other injuries were reported." Delta spokesman Brian Cruz said a preliminary investigation points to a malfunction in the cabin air system. A B-1B Lancer from the 9th Bomb Squadron at Dyess Air Force Base became the first U.S. Air Force aircraft to fly at supersonic speed using alternate fuel on Wednesday. It happened in a flight over Texas and New Mexico. The fuel was a 50-50 blend of synthetic and petroleum gases, being tested as part of an ongoing Air Force program to help the environment and to use a fuel produced domestically. Air Force officials are in the process of certifying the alternative fuel for use in all Air Force aircraft, something they hope to complete by 2011. The fuel is derived from natural gas using the Fischer-Tropsch process. The Teamsters Union slammed CEO Glenn Tilton over his management of United Airlines on Wednesday, saying it was time to run the airline like a company, not a tag sale, unquote. The union is bidding to represent mechanics at United. The tag sale reference involves the airline's announced plans to cut capacity and ground as many as 20 airplanes, or 4% of its fleet, and sell off certain assets. UAL has begun charging $25 to check a second bag, and last week raised fares by up to $50 per round trip for some routes. Teamsters General President Jim Hoffa said those added charges are little more than a new way for Tilton to pad his pockets, while his airline continues to suffer operational malaise. Quote, "Unless he shows genuine interest in rebuilding United, an airline that employees were once so proud to work for, it's time for him to go," unquote. United Airline mechanics are in the middle of a vote to switch representation to the Teamsters from the Airline Mechanics Fraternal Association. The voting will end on March 31st. Up next on ANN, Indianapolis spends big bucks to upgrade its airport experience. NetJets moves into India and says China is next. And the F-35 Lightning's engine of second choice passes a testing milestone. You're listening to Aero News.
Uncramp your style in a new Citation CJ2 Plus from Cessna. Now with integrated ProLine 21 avionics, FADEC, and a restyled cockpit and cabin. In the CJ2 Plus, you'll carry more payload than you could in the original CJ2. You'll climb and cruise faster. You'll have the freedom to use even shorter runways, and you'll do it all on less fuel. For a sure thing, call 1-800-4-CESSNA.
We're back with more of your Aero Briefing for March 21st, 2008. On the web, you can find us at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. When you think about premier commercial airports in the United States, LAX may come to mind, or perhaps Dallas-Fort Worth International. Portland International, near me, has won lots of traveler surveys and the TSA's Courtesy Award. But chances are, Indianapolis International would not make your list. The airport is taking a dedicated and pricey step toward changing that. The Indianapolis Airport Authority is nearly done with a $1.1 billion redevelopment project aimed at bringing IND into the big time. It's the largest civil project in the city's history and part of a larger campaign to make the Indiana State Capitol a force to be reckoned with on the global stage. John J. Kish, executive director of the Indianapolis Airport Authority, told the New York Times, quote, "We wanted to create a memorable new image for the city while at the same time take some of the stress out of flying," unquote. At the center of the effort at IND is a new main terminal designed by architect Ripley A. Rasmus of the HOK Group. The 1.2 million square foot structure is composed of steel and glass and has a swooping roofline intended to inspire images of flight. High-end stores, fine dining, and a five-story window wall overlooking downtown Indianapolis are part of Rasmus's stated intent to express the airport as a gateway to the city on the scale of the great train terminals of the 19th century. And there's function to go with that form. Initially, the new building will open with 40 gates. That's six more than the current structure, but it will be able to support as many as 100. Kish hopes the massive refurbishment will bring IND's passenger traffic up to levels the airport enjoys on the freight side. The airport is home to a major FedEx hub, but is only 45th among U.S. airports in terms of passengers. The new terminal is set to open on October 28th of this year. If you've doubted the boom in aviation in the Asia-Pacific region, take note. Fractional provider NetJets plans to launch operations in India shortly, and China is next. Reuters reports the company sees wealth creation in the region taking place at a phenomenal pace. In the words of NetJets Executive VP John Colucci, quote, "We think we'll get to our first 100 customers in India very quickly, and that will be just the tip of the iceberg," unquote. Colucci says the number of NetJets flights to and from India over the past 4 years is up 400%, many of them for high net worth individuals and businesses. Quote, "Our customer base is not affected by a market slowdown. Break even will be a few years down the line here, not many years," unquote. The GE Rolls-Royce fighter engine team announced on Thursday it successfully completed a high-altitude afterburner testing program at the U.S. Air Force Arnold Engineering Development Center in Tennessee, including common exhaust hardware for the F-35 Lightning II aircraft. The F-136 combat engine produces more than 40,000 pounds of thrust and is under development as a second engine choice for the F-35. The Bush administration has tried to end the second engine program, but proponents in Congress who want to keep it funded have exploited news of turbine blade fractures in test versions of the competing Pratt & Whitney F-135. That's the primary engine. Two pre-system development and demonstration F-136 engines have accumulated more than 600 hours of test time, which GE and Rolls-Royce say contributes to a significant risk reduction in the program. The first flight of the engine in the F-35 is expected in 2010. Another member of the famed Doolittle Raiders has passed on. Former Staff Sergeant Jacob "Jake" DeShazer died Saturday in an assisted living facility in Salem, Oregon, at the age of 95. The Air Force Times reports that DeShazer was the bombardier on the last of 16 bombers that took part in the Doolittle Raid, the daring airstrike against Japan in April of 1942. The six B-25 bombers launched from the USS Hornet to bomb Tokyo in retaliation for Pearl Harbor. The crews knew at the time they'd have to ditch the aircraft over China for lack of sufficient fuel. Three men died trying to bail out of their planes. Eight were taken prisoner by the Japanese, including DeShazer. Four died in captivity. DeShazer was held for 40 months, 34 of them in solitary confinement. DeShazer says he studied the Bible while incarcerated and later returned to Japan to work for 30 years as a missionary. DeShazer is a native Oregonian. In 2005, he was inducted into the Oregon Aviation Hall of Honor. His death leaves 11 Doolittle Raiders remaining. When only two are left, those men will open a bottle of Hennessy Very Special Cognac, vintage 1896, the year of Doolittle's birth, and enjoy one final toast. Still ahead, Dassault Falcon delivers the first customer 2000DX. AOPA fights a new two-lock law in Pennsylvania. And spacewalking astronauts test a new heat shield tile repair method. You're listening to Aero News.
Welcome to Cirrus Design, maker of the world's best-selling personal aircraft, the sleek SR-22. Cirrus planes feature the latest technologies and are equipped with an exclusive, life-saving parachute system. It is our mission to make personal aviation safe, affordable, and convenient. At Cirrus, we offer a test drive like no one else in the business.
Shoot happens. Come on, you know it does. Even the world's top test pilots know there are in-flight situations you can't always recover from. Mid-air collision, control failure, pilot incapacitation. In severe emergencies, do what the world's top test pilots do. Use a parachute. Except, instead of having to bail out of a moving aircraft, you can have the safety of a BRS full airframe recovery parachute. BRS has parachutes for an enormous variety of aircraft, from experimental to light sport, and all the way to retrofits on certified airplanes. Shoot happens. Will you be ready when it does? Call BRS today at 651-457-8651 or visit us online at brsparachutes.com.
We're back to wrap up your Aero Briefing for Friday, March 21st, 2008. I'm Paul Plack. Dassault Aviation announced on Wednesday its new Falcon 2000 DX entered service recently when Dassault delivered the first aircraft to a customer in the western U.S. Dassault introduced the 3,250 nautical mile Falcon 2000 DX at the NBAA convention in 2005. The first flight followed on June 19, 2007, and the plane was certified last year by EASA on September 19th and the FAA on October 3rd. The Falcon 2000 DX replaces the Falcon 2000 in Dassault's product line, serving customers who need the wide cabin comfort and excellent airport performance of the Falcon 2000 EX, but don't need the same extensive list of city pairs. President and CEO John Rosenvallen notes, quote, "And it's an ideal solution for customers with a focus on acquisition cost, fuel efficiency, and low cost of operation," unquote. What do members of the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association think of a proposal mandating two locks for general aviation aircraft? Their responses include terms such as intrusive, unnecessary, and just plain unacceptable. And that's the message AOPA is taking to lawmakers. AOPA Vice President of Regional Affairs Greg Pecoraro testified March 11th before the Pennsylvania House Transportation Committee in opposition to House Bill 2292, which would require two locks on all general aviation aircraft and create criminal penalties for failing to use them. Prior to the hearing, AOPA sent a letter and asked members to contact key lawmakers directly, actions that seemed to generate some opposition to the legislation within the Transportation Committee. Pecoraro told the committee that the legislation is unnecessary since most pilots already secure their aircraft, general aviation aircraft are rarely stolen, and the federal government has determined that general aviation aircraft are unattractive to terrorists because of their small size and minimal destructive power. Pecoraro also pointed out that voluntary programs, such as AOPA's Airport Watch, have pilots locking up and looking out for potentially threatening activity. AOPA is urging members in Pennsylvania not to let up on calls to lawmakers to make clear their opposition to House Bill 2292. The crews of the Space Shuttle Endeavour and the International Space Station got some off-duty time this week at the beginning of their 10th day in orbit. They also spoke to Japanese Prime Minister Yasuo Fukuda and participated in interviews with U.S. media. The astronauts spent the remainder of Wednesday configuring tools for last night's fourth spacewalk. The main purpose of last night's EVA was the test of a heat shield repair method using a caulk gun-like tool named the Tile Repair Ablator Dispenser, and it dispenses a material called Shuttle Tile Ablator 54 into purposely damaged heat shield tiles. Once the test is complete, the sample tiles will be returned to Earth to undergo extensive testing on the ground. And finally, Aero News was saddened to learn this week of the passing of 26-year-old Vicki Van Meter. You may not remember her name, but you will remember her major aviation accomplishments. At the age of 11, Vicki took the controls of a Cessna 172 and flew, accompanied by an instructor, from Augusta, Maine to San Diego, California. 9 months later, she made a similar trip across the Atlantic. Both trips received considerable attention in the media and touched off a brief wave of similar attempts by other young pilots. In 1994, Van Meter's record as youngest pilot to fly across the U.S. was broken by a 9-year-old girl. Any more attempts were outlawed after the death of 7-year-old Jessica Dubroff in 1996. Vicki stopped flying after her Atlantic crossing. She had illness brought on by high altitude, turbulence, and disorientation. She continued to speak of one day becoming an astronaut, but eventually earned a degree in criminal justice and spent 2 years in the Peace Corps in the former Soviet Republic of Moldova. According to the Associated Press, her family said Van Meter battled depression, but they thought she had it under control. Her body was found on Sunday in her home in Meadville. The cause of death is reported to be a self-inflicted gunshot. We hope Vicky has finally found smooth air. That's the latest from Aero News. Remember to check out the ANN special feature. Today, we'll hear FAA Acting Administrator Robert Sturgill's take on the safety and future of aviation in the U.S. from the agency's annual forecast conference. And if you haven't done it yet, subscribe to our AeroCasts. Find them on iTunes, Yahoo, Odeo, and at our website, aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.